percent. If you have a rule of 150%, why did you think 100% was good enough? Is it?
Well, what was communicated to us was, again, their goal of citing these on state-owned property, and also the second criteria is they want to locate where existing towers are. Mm-hmm. Again, this particular tower is 180 feet, which it meets all the requirements. I think it's a matter of trying to meet them halfway and, you know, provide the security and safety that we think is important given the number of people that use that frontage road on a daily basis. But there is space. It's a 19-acre site. There's about 2 acres, a little over 2 acres of area that it could potentially be located at to meet all of the county's setback requirements.
Well, and what I'm concerned is our own regulations, if I'm correct, say that we're not supposed to, that we can't accept a zero fall zone letter as, oh, okay, it's all right.
There's nothing that explicitly says we cannot, but there's no exceptions written that say if the applicant submits a zero fall zone letter, the setback requirements can be waived. Does that make sense? Some jurisdictions have that exception, and we don't.
Oh, you don't say we won't. Okay. But the fact that we don't have something that says it's okay for us to accept a zero fall letter.
Correct.
Okay. And I think they use the phrase theoretical failure in that zero fall letter. Mm-hmm. So, okay. That's it.
We keep talking about the Highway 30 right-of-way, but the Highway 30 right-of-way is one solid swath of right-of-way that includes the frontage road, right?
Correct.
Could you, just hypothetically for me, would the right-of-way be narrower if not for the frontage road? I'm really asking you hypotheticals here.
Yeah,
if Highway 30 just continued in a straight line and it didn't have to, did it bowl out to include the frontage road?
So the right-of-way line is the property line, and as you can see here, the property line includes some of the frontage road.
Okay.
So the right-of-way actually jogs back along this property line and continues further north as you go east.
Can you estimate for me the distance from where the tower is proposed to the center of the ditch between Highway 30 and the frontage road? I'll park it.
350 feet.
You talk about the green space just south of the frontage?
Yep.
Maybe less.
Okay, so we're way short of the required setback, even if we say, well, it's just a frontage road. What's really important is the traffic on Highway 30. We're still way short of the setback.
Yeah, they're proposing to be 317 feet from that south property line, which is the north right of the line.
Any other questions?
The proposed compromise is to put the location of the tower so that it's at least, I'll round up and say 400 feet back from the property line, though, right? Is that the proposed compromise?
The north edge of that frontage road. Again, the property line kind of runs down the middle of the frontage road.
Right.
And we were requesting 100% of the height of the tower setback from that north edge of the frontage road.
Okay. So if it does have a failure and the entire thing collapses, it would collapse on the north side of that frontage road.
Gotcha.
Assuming it falls in that direction.
Correct.
It falls to 100% of its height.
Right.
Correct.
No stray pieces.
I'm sure we can ask some questions to the applicant. Why don't we go ahead and give the applicant at the podium if you'd like to address the commission, and that'd be available for questions, that'd be great. And again, if you can state your name and business address for the record, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Joe Coyle. My address is 444 East 74th Terrace, Kansas City, Missouri, 64131. Good afternoon. Another tower discussion. We're here this afternoon on behalf of Motorola and the state of Iowa. As you've heard, the ISIX program is designed to provide emergency communications to first responders throughout the state of Iowa. We've been involved. Motorola is the vendor that will put up 84 of these locations throughout the state to increase public safety and communications in the event of a disaster. It would allow first responders from different outfits to all communicate together rather than all trying to coordinate on their separate communication systems. So this is a very vital project, and as explained, it's federally mandated. 95% of the folks in the state will be covered by this system once it is up and running. As has also been mentioned, the reason that this particular location was chosen is because it's IDOT property. So what we've been looking at is properties that are owned by IDOT, DNR, Department of Corrections, etc., and in the locations where they are needed to link up these microwave shots. In this case, the tower will be communicating with two other towers that are 20 and 26 miles away. We do have some representatives here from Motorola here that, you know, could answer some more of those technical type of questions about the required height that they've already attested to in our application materials and things of that nature. There were also some questions from you earlier about who would own the tower and things like that, and I also have someone from the Department of Public Safety, the actual director of this program, is here with us today, so he could also expound upon the importance of this program. And as Emily mentioned, one of the things that's very important with this program is the speed. We're trying to get this network up and built. Many other states have already gone through this mandated program. I was lagging behind a bit, and so we're really moving at an unprecedented pace to get all of the zoning and permitting done for these towers in these 84 spots, almost 84 jurisdictions across the state of Iowa. Now, some of these jurisdictions have laws on the books that will allow a waiver of their zoning requirements. These towers have been considered essential services in some jurisdictions because they do serve public safety, owned by the state, on state property, those types of things. There's nothing in Story County that allowed any type of waiver of your traditional CUP requirements. So that's why we're here, and we're trying to meet all those requirements best that we can. In this instance, site, you've heard that the main issue here, you know, everything else is great except for the setbacks. We're not meeting the setbacks. So the reason that that location was chosen, it's pretty obvious to see, is it's right adjacent to the existing tower. IDOT has towers across the state, and in nearly every instance where there's an existing tower, the new tower has been placed next to it. Cost saving, that prefab building that you mentioned will stay. You already have underground utilities running to the current tower. It makes the cutover that was mentioned by the Alliant gentleman, moving the existing IDOT communication antennas, moving those over to the new tower eventually makes that much easier. So those were the things that were primarily looked at when, you know, choosing the site was to put it next to the existing site. We do appreciate the compromise of the 100% setback. You know, it's a reasonable thought. I've had many conversations with Jerry and Emily about this, including the zero fall zone letter that you were all presented from Valmont, the tower manufacturer. That letter explains that monopoles and self-support towers these days are designed to fail at the midpoint and up. The taller the tower, the higher up you go. Your wind speeds are higher up there, and it makes it more likely that if the tower was to fail, it would not just tip over. It would not pull the foundations, you know, from three legs and fall straight over, potentially on the roadway, but rather it would just crumple upon itself. So we've been offering that letter to jurisdictions as persuasive to reduce the setbacks or to give us some type of exemption or waiver. For example, Cedar Rapids on the tower that I worked on there, that's a tower that's 360 feet, and we're only 140 feet from two major arterials right in the heart of town. The reason we chose that is because there's a state sheriff office there with an existing tower. So similar to here, the I-6 program chose that spot right next to the existing tower, presented the zero fall zone letter, and they looked at that as persuasive that, you know, it would still, the public safety, health, welfare would still be protected in the event of, unlikely event of a failure. One way that we would try to meet the setbacks at that current site would be, of course, to lower the tower height to get closer to that 150 or even closer to that 100% setback. And we've looked at that. Motorola engineers took another look at it due to the topography between the two neighboring sites. That's as low as we can get. You know, as I said to them, you know, it would make my job a lot easier, of course. You know, if we could knock that down a couple hundred feet, 150 feet, all these towers across the state are ranging anywhere that I've dealt with from 250 to 400 feet tall. So there are tall towers, but there's a reason for that, an engineering, RF engineering reason for that. And so this one can't be reduced to help meet that setback requirement at all. We've had an large amount of due diligence already done on this tower, which includes the FAA, also includes environmental studies and things of that nature that would seriously jeopardize our timeline if we had to move this tower even 100 feet north or so. Basically, with the FAA, you're looking at a 2C survey, which only gives you about 50 feet grace to file with them. A move larger than that would have caused us to refile. This was an extended study with the FAA because we're only 3 miles away from the Ames Airport. So to even get that letter from the FAA that the tower's okay, that you're looking at another 90 days, maybe 120 days, added to our timeline. And as I mentioned, speed of construction is important. We have about over 80% of these towers already zoned and permitted across the state. They've already broken ground on many of these towers, and they're building them right now in an effort to meet some of these strict federally mandated deadlines that we have. So just to finish up, you know, we really believe in the engineering of this tower, and that we don't think that it would be of great concern and negatively affect the health, safety, and welfare of the public. In fact, you know, the irony of it is that tower is there to actually protect us all. And so if there were a tornadic event, these things are designed to Rev G standards, which is the highest standard that's nationwide that would hold up in those are 90 mile per hour winds that they use, and then as you go up the tower it gets higher. There was some mention that they don't look at other catastrophes that could happen in the tower. The Rev G standard does include ice on the tower when they build them to those standards. They are including ice accumulation when they're looking at those. So I think that would basically wrap it up. I think Emily did put together a nice report here that outlines everything and includes the many, many materials that I've submitted to you all over the last few months. Like I said, I'm here. I can answer any questions you have, and then I will probably pass it over to Sergeant Tom Lampe with the DPS, just to kind of give his take on the program and its importance to the state of Iowa and your residents here.
You don't have to convince me that this is important. I think it's fabulous. Send it out in the middle of nowhere. And have got, rock and roll, baby.
Other questions? I got to ask the big question, which is, why would you invest in extensive due diligence on a location that doesn't meet the standards of our zoning code?
They placed them adjacent to existing towers all over the state, and they've used that zero fall zone letter to persuade zoning boards to go ahead and get it approved. They realize the importance of the project for the state and public safety, so in many cases that's been very persuasive, and worked with us on setbacks.
It's an interesting coincidence that we had another tower proposed on the same night, not far from here, and at a similar height. And I wonder if the public would be satisfied with that as reasoning for waiving, for ignoring a setback standard on a private tower that had nothing to do with the same public purposes. It was more convenient and less expensive, So that's a challenge that you're asking us to address tonight, is how do we treat all applicants equally and uphold our standards at the same time. So,
sure.
I'm sorry, that wasn't much of a question, but it's a tough situation for us.
Yeah,
any other questions?
Well, you mentioned the ease in that you're putting it next to a tower, but you're putting a tower up that's more than twice the height of the existing tower.
Right.
Right. So that tower in that location easily meets the setback standard for its height, right? Does that zero fall letter, is that an engineering guarantee that there's no way that that tower could fail in a way that would interfere with traffic on that frontage road or Highway 30?
There will never be a 100% guarantee that the engineer will stand behind the letter. As she pointed out, uses the word theoretically. They use their design standards, their experience in education, Valmont Towers, building towers for many, many years, have them all over the United States, and it mentions in the letter that there are very few cases of failure.
Right. I'm just thinking that I've lived in, not originally from Iowa, I've lived in Ames for about 12 years, and in that 12 years there's been, a 100-year flood, a 500-year flood, or two 500-year floods, and we've had straight-line winds, taking houses down and things. So the unusual does happen here. The theoretical does happen here, and so I'm less inclined to you know, to accept that in lieu of the setback personally.
I would add to what Martin said. Just a month ago, just in the northwest corner of the county, Lyon had 8 power poles go down.
Yeah, that's about 3 miles from my house.
It went down on my property.
Right.
So I know, well, it went down on the road, but Lyon had to go on my property to get the poles back up because the power lines were over the road. So I was amazed that the wind had done that.
Yeah.
And that was pretty, you know. So I have to think about that. And I would also say that I understand interoperability and how important it is. I was on the fire agency board for a few years, and it is a great goal. I think it's, you know, not only that, that's a real safety, it's a huge safety issue. That's what PJ's saying. We also have another safety issue here, which is about Highway 30 and all that traffic. So my real question is, I don't know that I would have proposed 100%. So I'm saying, why didn't you take that, but why can't you do the 150%? You know, I know that it's a money issue, but we've got a lot of safety issues here. And I guess I'm kind of concerned that you're not willing to look at following the zoning regulation that is there to protect people on that end of it.
Understood. And I can't speak to Alliant and their power poles. I'm guessing they're not engineered to TIA 222 REVG standards like telecommunication poles are, but I don't know.
It was something we didn't expect to happen, and it happened.
Sure. Understood.
Unless it's a joint use pole.
But the question is why aren't you considering, why aren't you looking more strongly at following the 150% if that is doable?
Cost savings, number one.
Okay.
Which is, with 84 sites, it's important. And maybe some of the other folks here can also touch on that. But the 150% standard, frankly, is a bit not in tune with a lot of jurisdictions these days. These are, I mentioned that in my conversations. A lot of 150% have been scaled down to about 100%, some even 50% in residential areas where capacity is an issue as far as telecommunications goes with private carriers. So we're seeing a lot of those fall zones changing. You know, we don't see as many guide towers, which is why a lot of the 150% setback ordinances were enacted way back, because those have more of a tendency to just tip over if you lose some guy wires. But with the monopoles that everyone's using these days and the self-support towers crumpling upon themselves, you're going to see a lot less than the 150% need in the majority of jurisdictions.
And at Mitchellville and Woodward, the state land there, how far away are you allowed to site these towers from the residential units at both of those campuses?
I don't know. I haven't worked on those two particular sites, so I don't know the zoning in those two jurisdictions.
I'm trying to remember how much land the state owns in each of those, and I'm not thinking there's a lot of Mitchellville. That's right. Anyways, yeah.
We're building on some very small footprints in many locations that do not meet jurisdictional setbacks along highways throughout the state. Absolutely.
Yeah, I was just curious, with these new towers that are being built, obviously the engineering has improved quite a bit, but do you have any idea what these new towers, if, I don't know how many failures have occurred, but what has caused them? Has it been wind? Has it been ice? Has it been something else? Just out of curiosity.
Just my personal experience, you know, being involved in the industry, I've seen wind cause them, and I've seen photos. If you Google online, you'll see, you know, monopoles just folding over. like such. Same with the self-support towers. That's typically what you're going to see is the towers folding over but not toppling over.
What about construction errors just in terms of as the towers are being built? Or issues that they have due to construction of the actual tower?
Oh, just not constructing them according to the plans?
Right, nature.
Okay, no, I'd never see that. The FCC watches these so carefully. You know, you have to run a geotechnical investigation to determine your foundation depth and things of that nature. We drilled a hole in this tower site here 50 feet deep to determine the soil makeup all the way up and down, and that goes into the design of the foundation. So all of that is very, very stringently looked at and would probably never be a reason for a tower to fail.
Did you have another question?
Who picked the spots to accommodate? I mean, given the criteria of Motorola, went around and looked at what was available and came up with what they felt was the optimal selection. Is that and how that worked?
Motorola in the state of Iowa. And Mr. Lampy could probably talk about the site selection process too.
Any other questions for that? Do you like anyone else to address us on behalf of the
applicant? Please, yes. If Sergeant Lampy could come up with the Department of Public Safety. And then if, like I said, if any other questions arise regarding, you know, the height, things of that nature, we do have Motorola people here as well.
Thank you.
Thanks. Hi. Thanks. Tom Lampy. I'm with the Department of Public Safety. I'm the Bureau Chief of the Department of Public Safety Communications Bureau. I'm also the chairman of that interoperability board that we discussed that started this whole project dating back to almost 2007. The actual project itself, getting it from the RFP, I practically drafted the RFP along with some engineering help, been through all the appeals, and so I've been in it from day one. And the proper pronounce is ISIX, not ISIX. It's too close to ISIS. I don't like that when you say that. So it's ISIX. I even come up with the logo, so I'm involved heavily, and I don't have to convince you on the interop piece and how important public safety is. That's a given, no doubt. I've got 29 years with the state as a state trooper, and 3 more years as a police officer, etc. So that's a given. I just found out about this issue here as the project director of this just a few days ago. And of course, there's 80 plus sites going up, so I don't keep track of all of them. I have a team that does that. And then some of this starts to come to my attention, like it did here 3 or 4 days ago. And that was a good question. Why didn't you? Why'd you go through all these permits? Because now that I have the heartache of, I've been told it's going to delay it another 6 months. Well, that's not good news to me, because we need a system. We've been needing this for years, and to finally go down this long road of getting this approved and a $100 million project valued to get this moving, and then have something that little things like this. There's always delays. There's always delays on the construction crew didn't show up, and the weather was bad, and they couldn't pour concrete, and here and there. And this type of delay is not good news, but I would ask that if we can work something out to where we can keep it moving within a reasonable amount of time. 6 months to me is a long time. I've been told this is supposed to be done by December. All these towers are supposed to be up by December with system acceptance in the spring and summer of 18. That's how aggressive this is supposed to be moving. So certainly appreciate anything you can do to help this project to keep moving. I do know the permitting process is painful when it comes to redoing all the paperwork. I don't blame you for asking that question. I had the same question. Probably we'll discuss it out in the hall after we're done. But I would appreciate any help you can give us. It is important. This particular tower, the height of it alone is going to eliminate one more site that the county needs to put up should they join this statewide system, because it's providing more coverage than it did when it was at a little lower before. So if Story County Sheriff's Office joins this, that's one less tower they have to put up. That's $1 million in itself. So that will help that. The City of Ames is crucial here also with the university, the protection of the city. They have no The campus police now have no coverage inside their buildings with the radio system they're currently using, so it is a concern. So the quicker we can get this done, the better. So, and I'll take any questions. The person who owns this is really the State of Iowa Department of Administrative Services. It's the one who signed the contract for the project. The ISIC's board, which I chair, governs the system, sets all the rules on how many radios can be on it, the capacity of it, protects the cores and the daily operation of it, and all the rules on using it on a day-to-day basis for interoperability. So if there's any questions in regard to what I can answer as far as the state or many hats so, or the board, I can certainly answer those for you.
Any questions?
And maybe similar what I asked the other gentleman, but so other than the fact that it would cost more money.
And some time.
But now to just say the 150%, it could be met at that site. It could be met at that site.
I'm not the engineer.
Oh, I was pointing at the diagram
okay.
on the screen. So it did show that there is some green space available there that would meet the 150%.
Okay.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Yep.
It's now time to open the public hearing on this. If there's any members of the public that would like to speak on this issue, would you please approach the podium and give us your name and address? Thanks.
I'd like to speak. Do I have to sign something? I came in late.
You do not have to sign anything yet.
Okay. Thank you.
If it were a big crowd, we might ask you to sign in. But
okay.
Actually, we would ask you, there's a sign-in sheet at the door, but you did not have to register a card or anything.
Okay. Well, I did sign.
Excellent. Thanks.
This is a microphone here, I take it.
It is.
And I have to say something. I have a handicap in that I don't hear well. So I have missed a lot of the conversations here. I have no hearing in this year because of surgery in 1986 up in Rochester. This year here, I have a $6,000 hearing aid in it, and typical hearing aids amplify anything and everything, but it's not like normal hearing. So some of it I may ask some questions that have already been talked about. First of all, my name is Donald Schumann. I live at 3209 Jules Circle, Ames, zip code 510. I'm very familiar with this 19 acres here and the buildings there because for 32 years I had an office that was on the second floor of the maintenance garage. So I know the ground very well. I know that where the tower is being proposed and where the present short tower is probably the wettest ground in the 19 acres because it's probably about the lowest ground on the 19 acres. As you go northward, the ground gets higher. The tower sitting back further north could be shorter tower, and the top of it would still be the same elevation as the top of the tower would be where it's being proposed right now. The other thing, I wonder how in this climate where we have ice storms and we have storms of snow, wet snow, that sometimes then the temperature drops, it is frozen snow. I would like to know how they keep ice and snow from accumulating on one of these towers. I was raised on a farm about 40 miles northwest of Fort Dodge. We had livestock, and we did not have electricity until 1946. Prior to that time, we had to have water. We had all kinds of livestock. We had to have water tanks. We had to have a windmill. Now, it was a little different shape of a windmill than what the tower is, but it's still a lattice type of structure. And in the wintertime, if we had an ice storm, ice accumulated. We had wet snow. It stuck on the structure. And then when it got cold, it froze. But eventually, the ice, frozen snow, would come off. When it came off, it was in chunks. And we had to be careful because before we had electricity, we had to keep a heater in the water tanks that were used coal or wood to keep the water warmed up so it didn't freeze for the livestock. Now, I know from experience, when the ice came off in chunks off this windmill, you better be careful you don't get hit. You don't look up for it because it might get hit in the face with it. I suspect that these towers probably accumulate ice during ice storms, and it comes off in chunks later. The tower that's being proposed is sitting right on the north edge of a large parking lot. Vehicles are there. Employees and visitors that have business with the DOT there have to walk in that area. And this includes in the wintertime. I have a lot of concern about the safety of the people that are going to be working around that area. People that have parked their vehicles there, I've got concern as a taxpayer. I feel that probably everybody in this room own a share in the property that's there. The ground and all the buildings, all the supplies, all the vehicles are there. And I don't think that's good management to be putting a tower that's going to ice up in the wintertime, and the ice is going to come off, and have the ice fallen on the vehicles, on the buildings, when the winds are blowing in the right direction. The ice isn't going to fall straight down. The wind's going to carry it wherever, whatever direction it's blowing from. That ground there is wet where the tower is proposed. It's wet ground. It's going to have a foundation that is a bigger foundation and more expensive foundation than if the tower was located up there to the north, kind of right where we called it the rock pile. It's off to the east side. It's well away from US 30. It's well away from the frontage road. And as I understand it from people that attend and are members of the Cornerstone Church, they have, at this time, they have about 3,000 members. Now, I've never been to a Sunday service there, but I'm told by people that do go to church regularly there that the huge auditorium that's at that church, they have two services, and they're packed for both services. Their parking lot's full of vehicles, but all those vehicles travel on the frontage road. I have a big concern about, well, I'm against a variance. I missed the presentation for Alliant Energy, but late last night when I was on the commission's website looking at the agenda and looking at Alliant Energy's proposed tower, it appeared to me that Alliant Energy was going to be in compliance with all the setbacks. And I guess I'd ask a question, is that right?
That's correct.
It's correct. So why shouldn't, if you're going to approve or recommend approval for a big variance here, I would hope that Alliant Energy, who I buy energy from, would come back and ask that you give them a variance too. They can save money. They don't have to go clear out in the field. They can get closer to the road. I just think it's, and I'm very disappointed that the people that were in charge of designing and proposing this didn't do their homework properly to start with. They should have been asking questions about setbacks. There should have been a lot of discussion about why put a tower like this right there in the middle of the most activity with buildings, expensive buildings. Who's going to pay if the ice falls, if this tower gets built there and the ice comes off in the wintertime and falls on the vehicles, falls on the buildings possibly, depending on the wind, who's going to pay for that damage? It's probably going to be whoever owns the tower. Now, I was under the impression that this tower was going to not be owned by the DOT. It was being owned by somebody that's leasing land from the DOT. Can you tell me, is that correct? Who owns the tower if it's built?
We were told tonight that it's the Iowa Administrative Services. Is that correct?
Division of Administrative Services, State of Iowa.
So it is the State of Iowa.
So who's going to pay for the bills when the buildings get damaged, there's a vehicle there, somebody gets hit in the head with some ice? Who's going to pay for it? Probably be the taxpayers again. I don't think it's going to cost very much more myself to move back up there by the area where that rock pile is, which is kind of, if you go along the east side, you get up there where there's something showing there, that's the rock pile, that area there. It's a lot better ground for a foundation, for a tower. It's away from buildings, it's away from the parking area, it's away from where people are around. I noticed that there's called an ice bridge between the proposed tower and the building that's there. I guess I wonder, what is an ice bridge? Can anybody tell me what an ice bridge is? And why is it called an ice bridge?
It's partially to help protect the wiring.
Yes.
That runs from the equipment building to the tower.
Is that to keep the rain off the wiring?
It's to provide protection from the weather.
It's to keep the ice off, isn't it? From hitting the cables. That's why it's called an ice bridge. So maybe they're going to put the tower there where it's been proposed. Maybe they build something over the buildings and the parking area, too, parking lot. No, I understand the need for this tower. I'm in complete agreement that it should be built. But I'm totally opposed to building it close to US 30. It's not a beautiful structure. It's close to the frontage road that carries thousands of vehicles in a week's time. If you've had the occasion to be by where especially the Cornerstone Church, but the Crossroad Baptist Church also, there's a lot of traffic, not just on Sunday. It's about 7 days a week, especially during weekdays, it's at nighttime. I think that the tower ought to be back up there, and as far as I can figure out, if it's around that rock pile up there, or even a little further north, it would comply with all the setbacks, the backs, the sides, and the frontage. And I appreciate you listening to me. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Schumann. Any other comments from the public on the application? All right, we'll close the public hearing then. And it's time for the Planning Commission to discuss.
So, looking at this map, looking at the picture with the my understanding, I want to make sure that I understand correctly, that the red square indicates the as designated 150% area. And then the blue is the kind of compromised area, right? So if I'm looking at that blue square and saying, okay, there's a compromise, right? And this is not a scientific study, but I did do a quick look at monopole communications failures, and if you Google that, the first pictures that show up are complete pole fallover failures. Not a scientific study. It's not an engineering report. It's just pictures of actual instances where when there's a failure, they went straight over. So the other thing, which maybe doesn't apply, but with Story County and the pipeline that was driven through last year, not personally in persuaded to say the federal government's mandating the system and therefore we should just abandon our given zoning requirements. So for me, if I look at this, there's not a great place if you're trying to use the existing location to just backset it a little bit to get within that 100% variance. So if there's not, and the next logical place is on the north side of that building where there's green space, you could do it outside the 150% variance in that small strip just on the south side of that red line. But if you're going to do that, then why wouldn't you just do it within the 150% variance? And if that's better ground because it's not wet and it's not low land, then why wouldn't you just stick to the 150% variance? And
well, in fact, it's not really a compromise either. It's a compromise that the staff is offering. It's not
understood.
Something that the applicant is even really interested in.
Right. No, I understand that. You're right. Like, poor phrasing was calling it a compromise, but it's an offer of a compromise.
Yes.
Right.
Proposed compromise.
Right.
So I had a couple of quick thoughts. One is you all know that we've dealt with other CUP applications
right.
that had no supplemental standards. And that's with some intention because it's supposed to be open to interpretation. We're supposed to deal with them on a case-by-case basis. But in this case, we've been given supplemental standards. I interpret that as these are ways we can clear this up and make certain portions of this application consideration black and white. So if in a conditional use permit, there's supplemental standards applied. To me, that means the supplemental standards, really, there's no room to insert our own judgment for those. It doesn't mean the standards are perfect, but it does mean the public and the staff and the leadership of the county, have taken that out of our hands. There's also this weird chicken and egg thing here where if we don't grant the CUP, the variance doesn't matter. If the Board of Adjustment doesn't grant the variance, then what we do doesn't matter.
Right.
Ken, if we were to remand this, would the applicant still have to come back to us first? If the applicant can't go to the Zoning Board of Adjustment for variance first.
No.
Just one here. I'm hearing Jerry say no. And that was my question.
Okay.
It has. We're first.
Right.
We have to be first.
First gateway.
Okay. That's fine. Okay. So does this go to the Board of Supervisors then?
No.
Okay.
Court of Justice is going to have a bigger, I mean, it's going to be, to me, a bigger hurdle to get the variance from the Court of Adjustment. If we're a recommending body, we can choose to ignore that setback regulation and make a positive recommendation to the Board of Supervisors, but the Board of Adjustment has to find that there's a hardship that has nothing to do with delays and nothing to do with money at play here in order to grant that variance. So I don't know. And
I can understand. I mean, at first I was trying to see how we do this thing. Okay, the variance is the Board of Adjustment's business. But how do we deal with that without looking at the regulations that are in front of us? That's my concern. That's my concern in voting, in taking the staff's, you know, recommendation. I can't say. I mean, I, as a Planning and Zoning Commission member, have to look at what our regulations are. I can't say, well, I can approve something and toss it to somebody else to see if they want to ignore the regulations. I'm just not comfortable with this. And if it's, you know, I understand, I used to work for a government agency, I can certainly understand wanting to make the best use of taxpayers' money, and I can certainly understand, in this case, wanting to get this project done as quickly as possible, but I think there's a balance here, because once that tower gets built, it's going to be there for a long time. And there's going to be a lot of weather, a lot of other things that can hit that tower, a lot of things that can fail. So I look at that and I say maybe a delay in some time and to have it where it should be is a much better thing for me to agree to or to propose than putting a tower where our zoning regulations say it shouldn't be.
I'm going to add, too, we're looking at it and looking at this as let's theoretically say we would grant, you know, complete variance, right, ignore the setback. We're looking at it, evaluating it based on current traffic on that frontage road, but this is in the Ames, designated in the future Ames industrial area, right? Ames is moving forward with, you know, in 10 years, I foresee that frontage road continuing on the other direction with, you know, all industrial in that area. So there's going to be, you know, the current traffic aside, there's going to be a lot more future traffic in and around that area as well. So it's not just a matter of what we're looking at for, you know, today based on today's data, but based on, you know, future data of 5, 10, 20 years.
Part of that too, Marvin, is there's that corridor study, and the current concept shows that intersection at Sandhill Hill Trail and Highway 30 further to the east, that intersection would be eliminated. But
yeah, proposed.
Yeah, you interchange further to the east, but then the frontage road would still be used.
Right.
But if I could just add, you know, part of our recommendation, you know, we felt that it still met the intent and purpose of the ordinance and also serves the, you know, the health and safety and welfare aspect of trying to provide protections of those who use that front yard. That's really the goal. And with our side yard setback, they only have to meet a setback equal to half of the height. And as, you know, what you're looking at there, that everything in that blue box would be the side yard on the east side and the west side.
Yeah, I'm just looking at that blue box and saying I don't see any benefit in staying from where it is currently located. There's not an advantage between the, unless you put it in, you know, the gravel area next to the building, right?
Am I
misunderstanding something? I mean, I see the compromise, right? Proposed compromise of saying you could put it any place inside the blue building and meet the setback requirement, the blue square, and meet the setback requirements. But from where it's at,
that would be the red to meet all the requirements. The
right,
blue
so is the proposed 100%, right? Okay, so I am understanding, and it's currently sitting at that small shelter that's right there. Right. So to try and use the existing building in its current location or some other, and try and, without relocating it, right, without relocating the shelter, the accessory buildings, how do you, you know, you could put the tower up someplace else and then bury the cable or, you know, whatever engineering marvels you want to undertake. But where would you put the tower that's from, based on where it's at, inside that blue square? Right, the only green space is on the other side of the building, immediately adjacent to where it's already the standard.
Yeah, to meet the 100%, you would probably be in the gravel parking area, to be honest with you, but there would be 35 plus feet from the south edge of that building to the tower to negotiate movement of the vehicles, the trucks.
Jerry, you pointed out that the side setbacks are substantially shorter, which suggests to me that, well, we've only been talking about safety, but it suggests to me that the intent is actually more than just safety, that unlike in an urbanized area, we have agricultural character and openness to be concerned about too, and that I infer that that is a big part of the intent behind the 150% requirement, because just on a pure health and safety basis, it's a bit robust compared to other ordinances probably, but that's where Story County is unique, so we're a rural, open county jurisdiction, so I think that's something we should consider too.
So your adjacent land use is primarily farm field to the east.
Right now.
For now.
Proposed
land use, industrial. So that's very possible to change.
Near the 400-foot tower is going to feel a lot different pushed up close to the highway corridor than if it's set back 593 feet. I
agree.
So if we do this, the blue square, they can put it anywhere they want to in the blue square.
If we do what?
If
as recommended by
staff recommendation, we allow that, correct?
That's staff's recommendation, but that proposed compromise has not been accepted by the applicant.
Or by the Board of Adjustment, who's the ultimate approver of that variance.
Exactly.
Are we ready to take some action?
Do you want to?
Could I ask one other question?
Yeah.
Okay, if we accepted number three, if we made that our motion, that would mean that the only recourse of the applicant would be to go to district court, correct? To appeal an agency action.
Well, if we would appeal.
If the board of supervisors agree.
It would be a recommendation.
The board of supervisors didn't have anything to do with it. Oh.
But this is a recommendation to the Board of Adjustment.
Adjustment.
Board of
Adjustment. Okay. I forget, we're just recommending to them as well as recommending to supervisors.
Right.
Okay. So, Board of Adjustment. Board of Adjustment did not take our recommendation or denied, and or, I don't know how they do it, but denied the request for a variance, then the recourse would be district court. And that takes quite a while. If we went the route of number four and remanded the conditional use permit application, granted time for the applicant to further modify and direct staff to place this on the Board of Adjustment meeting agenda.
It would likely come back here.
It would likely come back. Yeah, I don't understand why it would go to Board of Adjustment then if we...
It would come here. Recommendations to remand.
And it could come back if my applicant decided that they were willing to work with only 150% and try to make that happen and come back to us in a month, theoretically. So that would put them, and that would put them back 1 month on the Board of Adjustment. So that would be a 1 month, that could theoretically be a 1 month delay rather than a month, 3 months delay if you get tied up in appeals for the applicant. I just wanted to walk through that to see if I was understanding it correctly.
Right. If the Planning and Zoning Commission vote, with a majority vote to remand it, it would come back to the Planning and Zoning Commission at the May 3rd meeting, or at a later date, plus such a later date.
But it could be expedited.
The next scheduled meeting would be May 3rd.
Yeah, but it could be expedited, I'm sure, by your office if the applicant would make some changes to the site plan or to the proposed plan that fit within. Well, I haven't done the site plan, but would say they would work within the 150%. That can be fairly quick. Okay. Thank you.
Do we have a motion?
I move that we recommend the approval of the CUP, recommending approval to the Board of Adjustment without any variance to the standard setback requirements.
Is there a second? That motion fails for lack of a second. Do you have another motion?
I would move number 4, that we remand the CUP application to the applicant for further review and modifications, and direct staff to place. I want to stop it there.
Is there a second?
Second.
We have a motion by Merkin, second by McBride. Is there discussion on the motion? Whether the intent would be that you would hope that in that time, as the time passes to the next meeting, that they would come with a modified application.
It allows the applicant to do that if the applicant so chooses.
As opposed to just sending it on for denial and taking up everyone's time.
Correct. It gives the applicant an option to do this more quickly.
Well,
because the times of the essence.
So my motion was actually to approve it without any modification to the setback standard, which would say they have to put it within the 150-foot standard without exception. So they could actually choose to modify their plan and move forward very immediately with the Board of Adjustment instead of having to go back and say, we're going to have to modify our setbacks anyway, and then come back a month later.
We may be splitting hairs here, but we have an application before us that says this is the setback that we're proposing. So I think that we have to act on that proposal.
Okay.
So Linda's motion acts on that proposal, even if it just postpones it.
Understood.
A little time.
And is the remanding to give them time to come back with an application that meets all of the county requirements then for the setback? Is that the intent?
Are there other requirements that aren't met?
Just the setbacks. Just the front.
That's all that would be relevant or applicable then, I think.
It gives them that option. I suppose if they came back and wanted us to act on the original application with the original setback proposal, then we would just have to take action on that. Mm-hmm. Any other discussion on the motion? So we have a motion by Merkin and a second by McBride to remand the proposal until the next Planning and Commission meeting.
Well, just to remand it.
To remand it.
With no specific timeline.
Okay.
Correct.
I see. Can we get a roll call vote, please?
Steele.
No.
Merkin.
Yes.
McBride.
Yes.
Holstrom.
Yes.
Smith.
Yes.
Motion passes. So your proposal has been remanded back to staff and applicant for further consideration and review. It's at your option to bring it back with any modifications or to have it go forward at the next feasible time as is. Is that clear? Can we clarify that anyway for you? Got it? say the next feasible time, because we do have publication requirements and public notice requirements. So the sooner you can decide how you'd like to pursue it, the better for the staff and the public. All right. Let's take a short recess. 5 minutes. We will come back at 6:40. Take up the last couple items on the agenda.
Well,
all right, let's call the meeting back over. Excuse me.
That's fine. Let's get going. Let's get out of here.
All right.
Really quickly, we'll talk about some work order items.
Let's hear it.
For now.
Did you give us the floor to be honest?
Yes.
Okay.
I looked at you. May not show up in the table.
We did a community needs survey. We sent out a survey on February 17th to all property owners in adjacent to Quinault. We had 16 responses, which is 33%, which is really surprising for a survey that we didn't include, like, pre-stamped envelopes with. They had to mail it back to us. We were really impressed.
And what was the percentage?
33%.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Something significant, right? What is it?
I don't know. I didn't even look at
that.
We were impressed. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's a really significant. I wouldn't say that. Anyway. Yeah. So, first question, Stephanie, can you hit the light? That's okay. Thank you. There we go.
Can we have the Reader's Digest version of this, please?
So we asked, what are the most important services in your community? That what the county provides, essentially. And what we got was, most people said junk, vacant properties, and other nuisance/code enforcement. What do you like most about your community? This was an open-ended question. People like that it's small, it's quiet, there's rural character. It's friendly, they know their neighbors. Issues that for the community, what's problematic for your community? Again, vacant and abandoned properties, nuisance and code enforcement, upkeep and repair of properties, and infrastructure, including stormwater issues and road maintenance issues, snow removal issues. So the open-ended version of that is, what would you like to see changed? Property upkeep. Again, infrastructure issues related to the drainage of the town, people's basements flood, as well as road upkeep and snow removal. So, solutions. Because our instruction was to come up with a plan. So these are just a few thoughts we had regarding first nuisance and vacant, abandoned, derelict properties. We received, after the survey was completed, complaints about certain properties. Environmental Health Department currently has the public health nuisance enforcement capabilities, so they sent letters. So they sent letters to the property owners requesting a plan to come into compliance, and have not received word back as of today. So maybe we could do another mailing on how code enforcement and complaints work. Just some information. These are just ideas. You can tell us what great to go for. Another thought is that the county could purchase these vacant derelict properties. They're pretty low value. $5,600. One is just a vacant lot with a barn van house on it. The DNR actually provides matching grants for the removal and recycling of materials. So we can look into those if the county were to own these properties. They also do 100% grants for asbestos inspections. But we could also maybe think about providing more teeth for code enforcement, so not necessarily changing the way we take and act on complaints, but just saying, having more, in addition to public health nuisances, aesthetic issues, weeds, trees, more teeth to the Planning and Development Department to act on junk. Okay. So for stormwater and roads, there's no storm sewers in Quinault. I think they just use tiling for drainage of the town, which leads to some localized flooding. Additionally, we talked to secondary roads and engineering. They said they only have plans for maintenance of the roads. They don't have any direction for anything beyond maintenance from the Board of Supervisors at this point in time. The possible solutions, there's a couple grants that we thought of, as well as some loans to do infrastructure, green infrastructure improvements. What you're seeing in these images are some permeable pavers used instead of paving for roads. You're also seeing a bioswale in a ditch along a roadway in front of residential properties. And these two things were sponsored by a combination of Iowa Economic Development Authority grants through the Community Development Block Grant Funds, which are available if we do an income survey and show that there's a low-income population in Fernald, but there's also some loan programs out there that we could look into. So the next steps would be to contact the Soil and Water Conservation District, as well as IDLES. They provide free technical assistance on stormwater issues. They can tell us where the water is coming from and how to deal with it, at which point we could look more into what grants would be more feasible to apply for. But I think the big thing is we don't want to put a bioswale in someone's front yard if they don't want it there, so we need to do a community meeting once we have some more ideas on what some of these solutions could look like. Invite people, have pictures up, have dots for people to vote on what they like, what they don't like. That's it.
Amelia, do you feel like... Oh, can I respond now? Okay. Do you feel like there was any way to maybe combine like the idea of purchasing a property and kind of dealing with some of these like stormwater issues?
That's a great idea. I can definitely ask if there's if one of the properties would be a retention pond, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's a good idea. That's a really good idea.
If they happen to be located in the right place and it didn't cause runoff problems with neighbors and things. Where is this at? What town is this?
Fernald. That was a day town in incorporated city.
Fernald. F-E-R-N-A-L-D.
You haven't been to Fernald, you should go.
Just watch out for the dogs in the street.
It is a unique thing in Story County to have this little, I mean, there's a street grid.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definable blocks.
Was it on, was it incorporated previously?
I don't. Was it ever incorporated?
I don't know.
I don't know the answer to that. To be honest,
I mean, it's always been there.
We've got three of them. Iowa Center, Shipley.
If every lot were built, how many homes would there be?
Oh, there's a lot of lots.
Mm-hmm.
200 homes existing, maybe. 75 homes, maybe.
Possibly.
There's even some remnants of old, like, downtown-like buildings.
But since there's is an unincorporated, anything that gets done there, there's no city budget to have it done through.
Right.
It's county, it's or county. Potentially township. No, township. Only township would have to do is provide fire protection and anything
right.
for an unowned cemetery.
So it's county and or other agencies. Right.
Grants. It would be getting grants from the state, which the county could leverage.
So we talked to Leanne about county funding too, and they really never had one of these situations where it wasn't in one of the four categories. To get, for instance, she has TIF money for community projects.
Mm-hmm.
You can get money for transportation, parks, other things, but not really like stormwater infrastructure. That would be something she thought,
you could build a wetland park.
Right, that's what I was thinking.
Hey.
Is there a way to
on a vacant or damaged lot?
If the drainage were right, we didn't have to redo the whole family.
Right. Instead of completely tearing out the house, right, you tear off everything above ground, turn the basement into a retention pond, and build a park around it, and then you're, you know.
What is their biggest problem? Is that their biggest problem, that their basements flood and their streets flood? So the dilapidated structures.
Yeah.
Somebody owns those, right?
Yeah.
Are they delinquent on property taxes? Really? They just let them fall down, but they're not delinquent on their property taxes?
I
can't imagine the property taxes would be very much different.
Yeah,
if there's an extremely low assessed value, you know.
That's not the issue at this point that I'm aware of.
Okay, so what are the teeth that the planning department has now? You can send a letter, that's it?
No, we can't even do that.
When it comes to that, we don't have an adopted building code. Usually this type of thing would fall under a building code or junk. I think in the past our departments used a rural salvage yard type situation. That doesn't really apply here. Environmental health, though, did respond to to the complaint that we did get two of the properties, and they sent a notice of violation. So they started a process to try to get compliance.
But there are things called the main service. Elsina has a pretty good one. That it's not a building code, but it allows you to get at some more aesthetic issues. So instead of just looking at public health issues, you can say, oh, we got a complaint in that.
Because you have an abandoned car in your yard that hasn't been mowed in 4 years, right?
I don't know. That would be a better question. We don't have that in public health issues.
We're probably not going to. Problem solving is fun. We're probably not going to come up with solutions now, but it's interesting.
I do like the idea of a little more education as to how the code enforcement process works, so that they don't feel like they're being ignored when they see nothing happen,
right.
So that they know that, first of all, that it's a complaint-based system right now, so if you've got specific complaints, let's hear them, and also this is the process, and so it takes a little while to get it done, and you know that's probably a good thing to do.
I also like the idea of looking into, what did you call it, nuisance ordinances or minimum upkeep.
I would suggest a next step of offering or holding a meeting, and the reason I say that is because there's a lot of frustration sometimes when people are asked, are there problems? And they respond and say there are, and then they don't hear anything.
Yeah, you get a 33% response rate, which is astronomical, and then they don't hear anything and don't see any action.
But right. You guys wanted to do another mailing to everybody and say, come meet us. We'll have ideas, basically, or do you want to respond to the people that responded?
Yeah. Do they have a mayor and a city council?
No.
No, they're unincorporated.
Gotcha.
This is going to be very frustrating for them, too, then. Who gets the information? How do they facilitate all of this?
What did you just decide now that you're going to do another letter and see if people wanted to have a meeting?
We would hold one and just invite everybody.
Good.
That we sent to this group.
Good.
Where would it be located? Is there any
meeting? Well, we...
Do they have a community hall? Are there still churches there?
Hey, there's a ag business up in it down there. I wonder if you could work with them. You could hold it there.
Yeah.
I think that's a really important thing to consider.
Then what township is that?
Richmond.
I would invite the township trustees, even though they have no responsibility, they're the closest unit of local government there.
They've been working off the community.
Oh.
Well, they're part of the community.
Yeah.
So,
she said it like, it went in one ear and out the other. It must be tired. You said it was Richland, right?
Yes, Richland.
Okay.
Ferndale and Richland. Okay. Okay. Got it.
You got to go over for all. I mean,
yeah.
I love it.
It's a cool little place.
It is.
And what exactly is a Fernald? I've asked that time many times.
It was probably a family
name, I'm thinking, yeah.
Okay.
I'd be willing to go to a meeting just because, as a commission member, I'd be willing to attend. I think it'd be fun. Yeah, and educational and whatever.
Well, I relate to the small town.
Okay.
Construction / demolition, landfill, siting, and evaluation.
So, we've been working on this forever, and we have finally gotten some feedback from the DNR, and their feedback is that they can't approve these sites.
We sent them a map that showed potential sites adjacent to Highway 30, Highway 65, Highway 69.
Yeah.
And these were for the emergency...
Right.
Construction demolition. We have a map.
Exactly. If we have an event,
put debris, vegetated matter, household stuff,
right.
Construction
materials.
So they want to offer
a place to get it off the right of way.
Yep, I'm with you.
Yeah.
And I remember we talked about this
a
long time ago.
What we can do is, there's a are going to send us the administrative requirements for dealing with this kind of waste, and we'll figure out if we can meet those requirements on the site. And we still maybe entered into a contract and hope they would approve it at the time there was a disaster on one of these sites.
They wouldn't even offer any feedback because that would be tantamount to offering free
food. They'll come with us on the site visit. Oh, this might not work because of.
But why don't they? Why can't they pre-approve it, so to speak? Just because they don't?
It's an issue with the current guidance. I think allows them to waive certain requirements if there's a governor declared disaster, presidential declared disaster, and so if they don't feel like they have, without a declaration, the ability to approve.
All bets are off when there's a disaster, right?
Right.
And part of our charge is to get out.
Planning's not required when everything's half broken, right? It's just.
But if
we just find a spot and put it there, say that's a good spot, and go do it. But we can't get pre-approval to do that.
So we just need
to have a plan.
Right.
Well, we could have a plan. It's just that the plan then is the governor better declare a state of emergency. So we can get the DNR to say okay right away.
Yeah.
Right?
We're going to proceed, and I got out of the DNR that even if the governor didn't declare a disaster, and we had a local disaster in Washington, that they would then have some sort of ability to waive requirements and let us do it at that point. But they just can't do it before that happens.
And can they do it before that happens if there's nothing to waive, right? If we had 100% perfect location and said,
no,
this is where we're going to do it, and it meets all of the written requirements,
I
they
think
still
the
wouldn't.
The waiver itself would be for like a temporary siting.
Gotcha.
When you say we're going to proceed, does that mean identifying one or two sites and approaching the property owners about like purchasing an option?
Yeah.
Or
we're going to do as much as we can.
Okay.
For any eventuality,
yeah,
right?
Like a memorandum of understanding between the two parties.
So we have a contract draft that these landowners have responded back to the survey and did say, oh yeah, we'd be interested.
Oh,
right.
Do we know what other counties have done, or is there anything that
very little.
So we're cutting edge.
Cutting edge.
Okay.
No, we're on the cutting edge because we've had how many floods in the last 12 years where we've had.
Forced into that, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anything else on that then? All right. Staff comments.
The board staff is interviewing for persons who are interested in serving on the planning section for adjustments. They had interviews today and I think they're tomorrow. So hopefully, if everything goes well, they'll have somebody selected for the next week.
Wait, you had to interview to be on this commission?
Yeah,
that's what they're doing. Is that new? I snuck in under the wire? Is that...
I was for your application.
I was
interviewed
the requirements.
I was interviewed by the three supervisors.
Well, I wasn't...
Were you interviewed?
And staff.
Hello. Oh, yeah, I got to share.
Speaking of which, what's happened with your opening? Your staff opening. Did you?
Nice.
Did I miss it? Was there ever an official announcement? I assumed that Amelia was.
I didn't, I'm sorry.
Did I miss that?
I missed
it. But only because we go to school.
We hired Amelia as our planner.
Congratulations.
I'm welcome. It was Friday. And then she worked on it. Graduate degree in planning from Iowa State.
Oh, good
and
for
she
you.
In May,
she's
going to full time.
Cool.
Awesome. We are
more than ready to have her. And she's more than ready to have a job lined up for when she graduates.
That's awesome.
All right. Congratulations.
It worked out great.
Good for you. You apparently like the area.
Iowa State Extension is offering training for planning zoning commission members and board adjustment members. April 18th, Waterloo Center. April 24th, Johnston. Hilton Garden. We're paying for this, so if you're interested in participating, there's other location, other dates.
Did you already send that out to us?
We did, and then if you need something, Stephanie can take a note on who's interested. She would like something by Friday, so that we can turn that in.
What are the hours of the Waterloo train?
I remember seeing something. I remember thinking.
Are you sure that that's in Waterloo as well? I know that's the Ankeny.
Waterloo.
Thank you.
That's Waterloo Center.
All right.
Okay.
Are they all in April?
Right.
Are they all in April?
I thought there were three people who had signed up.
No, I didn't. But here's the thing. Okay, so can you go?
Is that Gary Taylor?
I didn't sign up. I might do this April 24th. So.
Is anybody else going to the April 12th at Johnston?
April 24th
is the one in Johnston.
We have three takers. Do you know the names?
Where's Johnston at?
Well, we have three people that signed up to go to Johnston.
I did.
DJ and Jerry.
Are Jerry's going too?
Where's Johnston?
West Des Moines, kind of northwest off the.
Right. That's where the Army base
is. Camp Dodge.
Right. Gotcha.
Copy the call or email Stephanie.
All right.
Well, you already got mine, right? Yeah.
That's all I have.
Okay. I have a question, actually. When we were talking about the Thomas rezoning, right? The first one on the agenda for the gas station. They mentioned that, hey, this is the business that's been operating, maybe not aligned with the zoning for, 10, 20, 30 years, whatever.
Well, I think they said 10.
At least 10.
They said 10, but they said that building was constructed in 1983.
Or a use that was permitted.
Okay. All right, and then it got transitioned at some point to, all right. So the question I wrote down when we were going through that is, how many businesses exist in Story County that are operating outside of current zoning or CUP or outside of current rules?
Define business, first of all.
I'm not going to define business. I'm going to say, this is an example, okay? Here's a gas station that's operating in an A2 zone. And it's convenience store / restaurant / gas station, right? That's got new CUP and is in an A2 zone, right?
It's probably just a permitted use kind of thing. I don't know if it requires permission. It was permitted initially in '83.
for the purpose that the building was constructed, right? Over time, that use changed, and for that to happen, for that to happen, you need plenty of zoning. Totally understand. I'm just curious to say, how not uncommon, right? And vary, I would quantify it even in an estimation would be great, but my thought is, and correct me. Is we do zoning, and the zoning dictates tax rates. And if you're in an A2 zone, you get very favorable tax rates compared to a commercial, light industrial zone. I'm guessing.
Well, it's probably in commercial classification. We can tell you what it is.
Residential classification, ag classification, and then the commercial classification.
All right, so we're talking about the difference between an ag classification and a commercial classification is potentially, you know, as a percentage-wise, relatively significant, would be my guess.
Well, commercial.
So just looking at it from a... just from a revenue perspective for the county.
So, I think I see where you're headed here.
No, I'm not looking at initiating something. I'm just curious as how much of this is going on.
But you got to separate assessment class from zoning class.
Okay.
And the assessor's office actively evaluates the actual use going on in the property.
All right.
Constantly.
Okay.
So they're probably relatively accurate.
They probably know.
But I don't know that there's the assessor's always saying, hey, that's a commercial use, but did you know what happened in an A2 district or an A1 district?
And I'm wondering, then what's the difference between the zoning and the assessment if people are doing it and the county, you know, the assessor's office is part of the county, and the county's aware of it, then...
That should actually be pretty easy to figure out if you just say that we assume that the assessment class is an accurate depiction of what it's being used for.
Right.
And does it agree with the zoning it's in? That's a GIS problem, right?
It could be determined.
Yeah.
Like this one is commercial class.
But what you don't know is from that is whether it's a legal nonconforming or an illegal nonconforming thing.
Well, please.
But I'm just curious, what's the impact then of the zoning? If it's separate from the assessment, then the zoning is just basically there for allowed use, right?
Right.
Okay, but if it's already happening outside of its allowed use for the zone, then that's the illegal.
You can enforce against it.
All right. Yeah. I'm just
enforce against it. Yeah.
So the question came up in my mind as we were going through it. Just, if it's happening here, then how do we know if it's happening and how common is it?
My follow-up question to that, and maybe it's in the materials and I missed it, is how did this come to their attention?
It was a request for a liquor license. It was a staff member at the auditor's office that contacted the fire department and said, hey, is it okay for the board of supervisors to approve this liquor license? And mm-hmm. That's how we got
involved. So by accident. So
departments working together.
Oh, it's interdepartmental.
No, because they could have just as easily said, send it to the board of supervisors and... It was an accident, which is nice, but...
No, this is rural Iowa. This is how this stuff comes up. I admire the family that's jumping through the hoops to get it. They want to get stuff done.
Yeah, they weren't trying to avoid anything.
No,
when the owner told them that this was commercial property...
They lied. They were lying.
Yeah, but I can see a young couple just saying, oh, okay, that's good. You know, it's... Yeah. You know,
but it's a commercial assessment,
right.
So they weren't necessarily lying,
right.
But...
Mm-hmm. The other thing that I might add is that the realtor actually called us.
Yes.
The realtor called and asked about it afterwards because everything.
Brad hit the fan. Are we going there? Yeah.
She called and asked. She said, on the assessor's page, I see primary class commercial. But there's primary zoning. Please contact
Sherry County Planning and Development, and it says that because it's a split zone. Mm.
Every time a property is split zone, it says that. But she or he or whoever.
They looked and they followed the instructions and they contacted the.
No, they did not follow the instructions.
Sometimes you're confused about class versus what zone it is.
Okay.
This is my frustration with real estate agents, is that this is something they should understand before. They tell a property buyer this is a commercial property. Well, what do you mean? Do you mean it's zoned commercial? Is it assessed commercial? Or is it currently being used commercial? Do you understand the difference between commercial and light industrial? You know, and what the zoning is.
From the applicant, that's part of what they were told. It was a restaurant. It was
a restaurant.
In itself, yes. Yeah.
And if you looked at the assessor site, it does say commercial and you know, whatever. So I'm not bringing this up because of them. They're doing the right things the right way, and they're moving forward. I'm proud of them. That's great. They're fantastic. I'm just thinking, this is whack-a-mole, right? It just popped up on a radar that hey, there's this one instance, and so we're gonna address this one instance, and what about the rest of them? And I'm just curious about how widespread is it? How much is it out there? And what's the impact of it?
Type situation. If you're asking how
we
go around.
So if we find it by accident because they're applying for a liquor license.
How we get involved is through sign permit requests, to be honest with you, because that's, you know, we try to find out as much as we can. Okay, what is a, you know, whatever it is.
Right.
And try to figure out, okay, where they're going, what zone, whether
they're using. But
approve it red, and then what else do you need to do?
I think Aaron raised a point, though, that there should be some ability to at least automate an evaluation by looking at, you know, the assessment versus the zoning. Okay. And that should at least give us a, you know, kind of a hot list to look at and say, you know, something at least an indicator to see, is there smoke? Is this something that we should look at versus, yeah, it probably happens, but it's not a big deal.
I think that's a good idea. But the other thing, excuse me, that I would think would be, how could you get others in the not the zoning system, but in our property system,
right,
in the community, to help? And I mean, okay, here's what I'm thinking. What if you send a letter to all the realtors in Story County? I mean, you need another project, guys. I know. But or you know, every office, and say, you know, nicely worded, but basically says, you know, things have come to our attention that sometimes information isn't given to potential buyers. And and they get themselves in maybe an unfortunate situation. You folks are in a really good position to help not get your clients in that kind of situation or not facilitate that. We'd like to come to a workshop.
Yeah, I would.
Come to a workshop, very, very strategically designed for what you want to accomplish.
I would approach it differently. I would still address that same audience, but I would kind of take Aaron's approach and say, we've had these instances come to the planning and zoning, come to the county planning, and you may not be aware of the differences between assessment classification and zoning classification and the impacts, and explain to them, here's what it is and here's what it means, and then here's how you can find it. So when you're looking at, which is probably what they do, they look at GIS and they pull up a property. When you're looking at it, if you see this, this is what it means. If you see this, this is what it means. And if they don't correlate, then that's a potential problem for your buyers.
Or if it's called the Planning and Zoning Commission.
Right. Here's what that means.
Do call them.
Here's what that means. And I don't know. Okay, so I'm sorry I'm keeping this here longer.
The first one that I've been involved with since I've been here. Yeah, you're right. Any other comments from the commission?
Good discussion.
All right. Do we have a vote to adjourn?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
You're adjourned. Thank you.